Let me read Genesis chapter 1 into chapter 2, verse 3. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was formless and void, and the darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was moving over the surface of the waters. Then God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. God saw that the light was good, and God separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning, one day. And then God said, "Let there be an expanse in the midst of the waters, and let it separate the waters from the waters." And God made the expanse and separated the waters which were below the expanse from the waters which were above the expanse, and it was so. And God called the expanse heaven, and there was evening, and there was morning, a second day. Then God said, "Let the waters below the heavens be gathered into one place, and let the dry land appear," and so it was so. God called the dry land earth, and the gathering of the waters he called seas, and God saw that it was good. Then God said, "Let the earth sprout vegetation, plants yielding seed, and fruit trees on the earth, bearing fruit after their kind with seed in them." And it was so. And the earth brought forth vegetation, plants yielding seed after their kind, and trees bearing fruit with seed in them after their kind. And God saw that it was good. There was evening, there was morning, a third day. Then God said, "Let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens to separate the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and years. Let them be for lights in the expanse of the heavens to give light on the earth." And it was so. And God made the two great lights and greater light to the greater light to govern the day and the lesser light to govern the night. He made the stars also. God placed them in the expanse of the heavens to give light on the earth and to govern the day and the night and to separate the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good. There was evening, there was morning, a fourth day. And God said, "Let the waters teem with swarms of living creatures. Let birds fly above the earth in the open expanse of the heavens." God created the great sea monsters and every living creature that moves, with which the waters swarmed after their kind, and every winged bird after its kind, and God saw that it was good. God blessed them, saying, "Be fruitful," thank you, "and multiply, and fill the waters in the seas, and let birds multiply on the earth." There was evening, and there was morning, a fifth day. And then God said, "Let the earth bring forth living creatures after their kind, cattle and creeping things and beasts of the earth after their kind." And it was so. God made the beasts of the earth after their kind, the cattle after their kind, and everything that creeps on the ground after its kind. And God saw that it was good. And then God said, "Let us make man in our image, according to our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the sky and over the cattle and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." And God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. God blessed them, and God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it, and rule over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the sky and over every living thing that moves on the earth." And then God said, "Behold, I have given you every plant yielding seed that is on the surface of all the earth, and every tree which has fruit yielding seed, it shall be food for you, and to every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the sky, and to everything that moves on the earth, which has life. I have given every green plant for food." And it was so. And God saw all that he had made, and behold, it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day. Thus the heavens and the earth were completed, and all their hosts. By the seventh day, God completed his work which he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work which he had done. Then God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because in it he rested from all his work which God had created and made. May the Lord bless his word. Well, today we're going to obviously go through the biblical account of creation. I've given you three sermons to build up to this point. I'm not going to give you a reminder what those sermons are. They're all available. You can get them from the app, from our website, and I would commend you to listen to them so that you can be understanding why I may be skipping over some things and I'm pressing hard on others. In this, what we have is the beginning of a series through chapters 1 through 11 of Genesis, because that series of chapters deals with so much of what we live within as human beings in this world. Just to name a few of the things that it touches on and explains why things are supposed to be a certain way. It speaks to the origins of all things, the nature of humanity, the nature of gender roles, of gender identity, marriage, population control, environmentalism, national identity, racism, racial identity, geology, capital punishment, origins of government, and language development. Every one of those things are explained as to why they are the way they are. It doesn't get into the nuts and bolts, but it gives you the foundation from which you can spring and begin to appreciate what is taking place before your very eyes and why things that are happening in our nation are wrong, but more importantly, why they are wrong. Why you should argue a certain way as a Christian for what you believe, rather than it just being tradition or it's always been that way. None of these things I just listed, and I could have gone on, but none of these are small matters, and most of them are very important to us in the events that we see unfolding right now. Not my goal to try to debunk all the arguments against Genesis 1 or 2. I'm not going to do it because it would be a work of futility. The reality is in Romans chapter 1, it says that we as humans, apart from the saving work of Jesus Christ, we by nature suppress truth, and we are in the process of constantly suppressing truth. And so you can fight and fight and try to come up with every argument to deal with people who are saying, I don't agree with that, I don't agree with this, and at the moment you answer that, they'll find a new one. And if they don't find it right away, they will go looking until they think they have one. And you can become exhausted just simply trying to give an answer to all of that. What I want to do is just give you a faithful proclamation of this is what Genesis 1 says. And then I also will be providing for you, and am already doing so, various resources that do an excellent job in answering some of the most common and even not so common challenges to what I will be teaching. In fact, right now, there is on our Facebook page the first of those, and it is a textbook that is designed with the understanding of the literalness of Genesis chapter 1 and 2. If you are a parent, go buy it. It's not expensive. It is an excellent book. It's for really middle school on up. I will promise you, middle school, it'll be a bit hard. It won't kill them. That's a common statement in my household. It won't kill them, but it will challenge them, but it's awesome for your kids who are heading into high school. And if you have kids who have never thought about this, I don't care if they're homeschooled or what, if they are heading off into college, they're going to be inundated with this stuff. And it would be an excellent book for you to give. It's got excellent footnotes and will open up their eyes to a lot of information that they didn't even know existed. The Bible makes it clear from the beginning to the end that Yahweh, and I'm going to use that name, the true name of our Lord, as given in the Bible over and over again, because I want to start separating our minds away from a vague God or the God of this person or God of that person to the God of the Scriptures, that it is that God, Yahweh, who is the creator of all things, that there's only one God and that there are no other gods. He shares his glory with no others. This is how you deal with people who have never heard the Word of God preached. They've never been brought up in the church. They've never heard the stories of the Bible. This is how you begin to talk to them. You have to deal with the starting point. And the starting point isn't that God loves you and has a wonderful plan for you. The starting point is that God made you. And he made everything. It is always going to start with the starting point of God as creator, which is why Paul in Athens, Greece, standing there having to give an answer for his teaching to all of the religious and political leaders of the time, he starts out with the proclamation that he worships the God who made all things. And by doing that, he sweeps every other one of the gods. And there were thousands upon thousands there in Athens. He sweeps them all off the table of discussion. Because if God has made all things, then whatever idol they worship, whatever person they think is a deity, they are under the Creator God who made everything. Along with that, you see that the New Testament takes Genesis chapters 1 through 11 very seriously. Well over 100 references to these 11 chapters. Jesus himself uses and points back to these chapters 15 times himself. Always assuming them to be true. But not only that, but when you get into the Bible and you start to read it a little bit maybe more carefully, this happens after you've read it one or two times through, you'll start to realize that this idea of God as creator is literally woven through every page. And it's a wonderful way that it happens. And so it's so tightly woven in there that you almost can't help but miss it unless you're not looking for it. It's kind of like the doctrines of election or the deity of Jesus Christ. We don't have like five verses only that tell us that Jesus is God. You can't read the New Testament and not see the deity of God woven, of Jesus, woven through every single page. And Matt Miller is already doing a wonderful job of beginning to show you that, and he will do so for the next many, many months. In the same way, just consider this. In Exodus chapter 5, verse 2, Pharaoh challenges Moses, who has just told him, look, I am here as a representative of God, who is Yahweh, and I am telling you to let his people go. And this is what Pharaoh says. He says, who is Yahweh that I should obey his voice and let Israel go? I do not know Yahweh. And besides, I will not let Israel go. He's like, go away. Shut up. I don't know this Yahweh. So what is the answer? Well, from that point forward, plagues is the answer. All right, you don't know who Yahweh is? Let me introduce you to him. Now, if you didn't know it, every single one of the plagues was against one of the gods of Egypt. And what it was showing was that the gods of Egypt could not protect them from Yahweh. And at the very end, in chapter 12, which is going to be the high point or low point, depending on which side of the death you're going to land, is the death of the firstborn. Now listen to what it says in verse 12 of chapter 12 of Exodus. For I, this is God speaking, for I will go through the land of Egypt on that night and will strike down all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both man and beast, and against all the gods of Egypt I will execute judgments. Why? Because I am Yahweh. And that's that. There is no discussion. He says, oh, they will learn who I am. Who is Yahweh? I don't know this Yahweh. You do now. But if you think about it, built into that is the fact that God alone is the maker of heaven and earth. And so without ever exerting any sweat of his brow, he just defeats the various gods, the gods of the Nile, the god of the flies and the locusts and the gods of the cattle. It doesn't matter. You worship the sun god, I'll make it dark. You worship this god, I'll make this happen. Why? Because he is the creator god. It's just woven into it if you only open your eyes to see it. So with all of that, let's look at Genesis 1 and the 6 days of creation. And all I'm going to do is, I'm not going to do anything exciting, but I am going to just take you through this text and make key observations and some illustrations. In day one, we find that it was without form and void. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was formless and void. There it is. I want you to notice those two words, formless and void. It had no form and it was empty. Because this is going to come up on the slide or screen, whatever they're called, very shortly, that what you're going to see in chapter 1 is all God is doing is now starting with this formless and void earth, And then he makes it no longer formless, and then he fills it. And that's all that's happening in this, and it's kind of cool when you see it. Picture it like a lump of clay. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And at that moment, he takes the earth like a lump of clay and he slams it down on the potter's wheel. And just sitting there, a lump of clay. Now cover it in water and you kind of got the picture. There's no purpose to it. There's nothing there. It's just kind of this lump of reality. And then God begins to form it. And God begins to fill it. And in that, we have the Spirit of God moving over the surface of the water. Very fascinating phrase, and there's a lot of mystery built up into it, but it's the idea of this intense scrutiny by the Spirit of God as the Spirit of God is poised over the earth, ready to work, ready to function. Now, what he is waiting for and why he doesn't begin to do anything is that it is not his job to speak into anything into existence. The Father is the architect over all things. And in that, when he speaks, the Son, who later becomes Jesus, the Son then sends forth his word, and the Spirit is the one who then executes all of that. So you've got the Spirit of God, basically, picture him like in the starting blocks of a race, ready to go and just simply waiting for the word. And when the word comes, he creates. In verses 3 and 5 through 5, what we have is the creation of light. And here we see the first word of creation. And what you have here is a very standard formula. I'm going to bore you maybe a bit with this, but I will do it quickly. I'm only showing you this because there is a common popular argument today within evangelicals who are trying to make Genesis 1 not have anything to do with really, truly creation. And the argument that is most popularly used is that this is only poem. It's a poem. And because it's a poem, we don't have to take any of this literally. It's designed to, in a poetic way, describe God as being the God over all things. And how it all worked doesn't matter. The fact that he goes through this series, it's a nice thing, but don't look at it literally because it's not important, because it's just a poem. The problem is it's not a poem. And if you know anything about Hebrew, and Hebrew, which I know you don't, but it's not hard to read about, and how Hebrew poetry works and parallelisms work, you'll understand there is none of that functioning in here. This is a typical formulaic process of writing. It's prose. It's just simply stating one thing after another and how it happened. And so there's a formula actually built into this chapter. The first is that there's an announcement, God said. Second comes a command, let there be. The third is the fulfillment, and it was so. The fourth is the execution, light, whatever, division of water, the making of birds. The fifth, then, is of approval, that it's good. The sixth is that God then describes or names that event, such as this is now called day. Seventh, then, there is a numbered day. He says, this was the first day, the second day, the third day. So when we see the phrase, God said, it's not just God chatting. It's speaking of his sovereign will being expressed, a very full term. It's his sovereign rule, that he is king. He's speaking as king. He is expressing his will, his wishes. And when he speaks, it's not something that he hopes will happen, or over a span of billions of years, eventually it may come to pass, but we don't really know because it's really a lot of random series of events that must come to pass that will ultimately bring about light. He just simply, I want you to see how simple it is. Let there be light, and what happens? There is light. It is an expression of authority, of omnipotence, of wisdom, and of certainty. It is a divine fiat that God has expressed his command, and it simply is. Beloved, we sit here, and honestly, I'm looking at you. I make no judgment of you. I'm the same way. We look at that and we say, okay, yeah, we should be afraid. We should be afraid. We are so arrogant as people, are we not, that we think that we somehow have some rule or right and that we can push back. And in our nation, because of the way our Constitution's written and how things function, we actually believe we have the right to argue. And we argue constantly. And we make appeals and we sue. And then we appeal that when we lose. And we keep fighting it. And we keep thinking we can elect these people and get those guys done. Everything will be okay because we have these rights and we're going to make them all happen. And yet when you look at how all of creation is situated before God, you have God and he just says, light, it's time, and it's there. And beloved, can I say that when he says, light, be gone, it's going to be gone. It is he who spoke you into existence. And it is he who holds your soul, and it is he who will cause you to die. And you should tremble before him. But it is also one to whom you can hope if you have Jesus Christ, right? If you are rightly related to your Creator, what a wonderful place that is. Because now you have one who is the God who made all things. Well, he is one I can hope in. He is one in whom I can pray to. He is one in whom I can find rest in my time of great need. This is how Jeremiah would say it, the prophet, to a nation that is literally being beaten to death by their sin. He says, ah, Lord God, behold, you have made the heavens and the earth by your great power and by your outstretched arm. He asserts God as creator. What is the consequence? He says, then nothing is too difficult for you. And yet, how often do we act as if everything is too difficult? How often do we not have, as Jesus says, because we do not ask? Isaiah says it a different way in chapter 42, but it's all dealt about as God as creator. He says, thus says God, Yahweh, who created the heavens and stretched them out, who spread out the earth and its offspring, who gives breath to the people on it, the spirit to those who walk in it. I am Yahweh, and I have called you in righteousness. I will also hold you by the hand and watch over you. And I will appoint you as a covenant to the people, as a light to the nations. Here he is now bringing about and speaking of a prophecy of his son, the Messiah, Jesus Christ. I will appoint you as a light to the nations to do what? To open blind eyes, to bring out prisoners from the dungeon, and to those who dwell in darkness from the prison. I am Yahweh, that is my name, and I will not give my glory to another, nor my praise to the graven images. He premises the whole fact that he is going to bring into this world his son, the Messiah, who will bring life to us, all premised upon he is the Lord who has made all things. Everything will always go back to him as the maker of all things. That is our hope, that he can do whatever he says he's going to do. We see the Trinity in this as well. I commend to you Matt Miller's series on the Word of God and the Spirit. It's a short series, and he deals with this relationship of the Son of God with the Father in the Word. And so I'm not going to spend the time developing it here, but basically understand that through the second person of the Trinity, the Son of God, or the Word, the Father created all things. So when you see God speak here, you should understand that the Father's the architect, so to speak. The Son is bound up in him speaking, but he is the one who does the actual creating, and the energizing power of that is accomplished through the Spirit. So you have the triune God intimately working together to bring about God's will. And the first act is that of light. Notice it's just light. What follows is some stuff I learned about light, and I hope that I can kind of excite you to read the books that I'm going to recommend to you. In the preparation for Genesis 1 through 11, I've read almost 10,000 pages of just stuff to prepare to give you just a few hours. So I'm trying to figure out what can I tell you and not bore the pants off you. But I'm going to be telling you about many books that you can read, and you would be good. It would be good for you to do so. The first thing is just light. Light is an amazing thing. This thing that we call light is called the electromagnetic spectrum, and it's made up of all kinds of radiation. And we know two of them. So in this creation that we dwell in is this the spectrum of electromagnetic radiation. And it permeates all of nature, and we know two of them intimately well, because without them we would be dead. They're called light and heat. Now this spectrum goes all the way throughout nature, and the wavelength of this spectrum, okay, picture this line of what types of radiation are on this and are possible, okay? This spectrum is so broad that it reaches out to 10 to the 25th power, which maybe if you're one of those annoyingly smart people with math, you like are already saying, wow. I'm like, all right. So let me show you what that means, and you'll still not get it, but maybe you'll be a little more impressed. If you were to take 4 billion years and mark out every second of 4 billion years on a line, your line would only extend to 10 to the 14th power. The spectrum of electromagnetic radiation and all of its types and whatnot extends 10 to the 25th power. It is beyond our comprehension to even grasp the complexity and the vastness of that thing in which God says, let there be light. Now, imagine that you can imagine that length of that line. You can't, but let's pretend. And then understand that somewhere on there is a spot that's on that spectrum that's so thin that we could not even find it. We can't even think of it. But in that spot is the only spot on that entire spectrum in which photochemistry can occur. And photochemistry is needed so you can have life. So you've got this incredibly long spectrum, and on that spectrum, only one spot that's tiny beyond tiny, and only there, anywhere else it can't happen, that's where photochemistry occurs. And that's what we call light. It's what our sun does. It just happens to emit the radiation that is the exact range needed for life. The exact range. And it's always done this. If you reject God as creator and you're just saying that it all happened through a series of accidental processes that colliding atoms and this and that, and that produced this sun that then produces light that then warms this planet, I want you to get your head around the possibilities of something like that happening on that spectrum that just happened to hit that target. And then I would go and play the lottery, because your chances are far better than playing Powerball. Add to this fact that the light is made up of things called particles, but it's also made up of waves. For the longest time, science couldn't deal with that, because light can either be a particle or it can be a wave. It can't be both. But they've come to accept the fact that, well, it does, though it's not supposed to. So they don't know why it does it. So again, I'm saying this not to do anything but to show you that science doesn't even know some of the most basic questions of basic things, but they claim to know all of this stuff that they have not even been able to see. We should not be that impressed. We should delight in science. It's a gift. But don't be too impressed with their knowledge of ultimate things. So they've discovered that, well, it's made up of particles, but they're also waves, even though they're not supposed to be, but they are. And then they go down into it, examine light at a quantum level. Don't even ask me. I don't know. But smart people know. And they get into the quantum level of these particle, what they can now call particle waves. They're like, well, let's just accept they are, and we'll call them particle waves. We'll make up a phrase. And when the light is examined then at the atomic level and how it functions, and they do that through those big atomic colliders, particle collider thingies. That's a technical term for you, thingies. All right, for less informed people, that means stuff than junk. But the scientific folks appreciate me throwing in that kind of jargon. When the light is examined at that atomic level, you know what they find out? It doesn't function like they think it has to function. They can't make sense of it. It does things that it shouldn't do. It violates everything they think it should be. And yet it's just happily doing what it's doing at that level. That leads to something that's even more cool called quantum tunneling. Quantum tunneling is way too complex for me. But suffice it to say that it's necessary for life to exist. So at this quantum atomic level, light that they don't understand how it's doing what it's doing or why it's doing what it's doing, but is doing what they call now quantum tunneling, moving through things. Light is functioning, and it's moving through as a particle. And so happily picture at that tiny level, a particle of light just going through and doing whatever quantum tunneling is. The problem with it is that it will meet things that it can't go through as a particle. So guess what it does? Now, we're talking tiny, right? It turns into a wave. It just like bump. Oh, can't go through. I'm a wave now. And it goes right through. And then when it's through, it doesn't need to be a wave anymore. Guess what it does? It becomes a particle again, happily continues on its way. And they have no idea how that works. But they do know this, that without that quality, there could be no life. So when you say, let there be light, there's a lot going on in that word. And I would commend to you a book by a man who's an evolutionist, a man named Michael Denton, who wrote a book, Children of Light. It's really cool because he writes to normal people, even though he'll still lose you. But he footnotes incredibly well. So you can go, if you're really into science, you can go back into stuff that will, you know, support everything that he is saying. What God said, though, was it is good. It's the picture of an artist who admires his works, and he looks back and he says, this is good. This is what's right. I approve of what I have made. But it also helps us remember that at the very beginning, God created all things, and he says, let there be light. And it's interesting that what he calls us out of is he calls his people out of darkness and into light, right? And he calls his children, children of light. And he says that we have been transferred out of the kingdom of darkness and into the kingdom of the light of his Son. And he says that we are to walk in the day and not in the night. All of this imagery of this light and darkness is built even into the Genesis passage where he brings into formlessness and chaos, the first thing is light. And then he separates light and darkness and says they have their abodes. And there is that which is light and there is that which is darkness. And so he separates them. He gives their places. He names them, which is God divinely identifying his creation. And again, this is a sovereign act. It's one in which he determines, because he is the maker, what the name will be. And then there is evening and morning one day. By the way, we don't do it right. We do morning and evening as a day. The biblical way is there's an evening and a morning. And that's how a day is marked out here. And so you should notice that. But it's a length of time that took place, and there's absolutely no reason from the Bible passage itself to think that this day and night was anything but a day and night. People say, well, yeah, but there was no sun. So what? He made night and he made day. And he says it was one day. Can we not just accept that night and day, one day? It is the standard formula throughout the Bible to always describe one day. In fact, I'll be brutally honest to you that when people try to tell me that it's not that, because they're not going to show it from the text, they're going to work out massive quantities of pages to tell you why one day doesn't mean one day. And I'm going to interrupt them because I just don't have the time anymore. I'm getting old. And I'll look at them and I say, there's only one reason and one reason alone that you don't think this is one day. And that is for whatever reason you have bought into some evolutionary argument. That's the only reason that you're doing this. Because there is no way you're getting it from the text. The second day, it will go quicker from here, so don't despair. Day two, he separates the waters. He talks about the firmament or the expanse, and its purpose was to divide the water in the sky from the water in the sea. And now he calls it heaven, not the abode of God, so to speak, but it's just the sky, the atmosphere. And again, we have light interacting with the atmosphere, and it's something that's incredibly unique. It's worth noting this, though, that for everything we know and are still learning about the way our earth is made, the one thing that they are certain is that the first thing that we needed was water and an ocean. Without the ocean, we could not, this world would not function. And it's very fascinating that on the first day, the waters of the earth covered it. Because the ocean is needed for everything that follows, from the movement of the plates of the earth to the hydrological cycle. The problem with it is that science doesn't know how water came onto the earth. Have you not noticed what is the one thing they're always looking for when they're landing something on some other planet? They're always looking for water. Why? Because there isn't water. There's just none. And you can't do anything without water. You got to have it. And so they're desperately trying to find water somewhere else, but they can't find it, and they have no idea how it got here. Remember, if you just happened and things exploded and atoms were colliding and matter was coming together, all of that had to come together, and somehow water somewhere was forming, because water's weird if you think about it. You can pour it. You don't sit on it unless it's frozen. And somehow that had to show up on Earth. They don't know how it is. This is their two best guesses, and they're sad. One, they think maybe a comet went by really, really close, and it had a lot of water, and somehow the Earth got it. I'm not joking. This is how. The other best guess is an asteroid that had a lot of water on it. Now, remember, all they're doing is pushing that back, because now they're saying the comet had it. So what's my next question to them? How'd the comet get it? We don't know. All right, so we have an answer squat. So an unknown comet flying around happened to come just close enough, and it just happened to have water that we have no idea about, and it comes and it decides, I don't want the water anymore, I'm going to dump it on the earth. Well, that was nice of it. Well, no, that's not them. I'm being snarky, but I'm having fun. The other one is an asteroid happened to be covered in water, and it happened to crash into the earth, and it happened to deposit all the water. I'm just really content to say God put it there. It's not any harder to believe, but it is necessary for life. And they have no idea how it got here. On the third day, then, here we now are no longer forming. What we're now doing is we don't have this light, apparently. Or do we have this light? Yeah, I wanted it up the whole sermon. Yeah. Now we're filling. Okay? So we've up to now we've been putting form to everything. And now what we're doing is we're beginning to fill this creation that he's made. So now it's not merely organizing. It is merely organizing what exists. He separates out the land. He causes vegetation to sprout. And it's all done in its proper order. So let me talk again about water, just like I did about light, because it's very amazing. Did you know that if you didn't have water, we wouldn't have soil? We'd have rock, but we wouldn't have soil. Without water, soil doesn't happen. But because of the unique properties of water, it and it alone, because of its viscosity, that's a cool word, because of its viscosity and the exact viscosity that it is able to take rock and turn it into soil. Not only does it break it down through erosion, but in the process, it creates all of the constituent minerals necessary for soil to be soil and grow stuff. The viscosity of that water is just right that it is essentially liquid sandpaper. In fact, it is the most perfect solvent in all of the universe. It is able to break down everything given time. This viscosity, though, of water is not important just in the liquid state, but also in ice. Check this out. When you make ice, it's brittle, right? You hit it with a hammer, it's going to shatter. Not true, though. Once you start piling it up and it starts getting thicker and thicker and thicker, we call them glaciers. The ice that's at the bottom of the glacier is not the same as the ice at the top of the glacier. The water, the way it's built, it freezes, and as it comes under pressure, it becomes, now check this phrase out, it becomes a solid fluid. That's kind of like a particle wave. You're like, what's a solid fluid? It's ice under pressure. So all of that pressure of the other ice sitting on it, it changes. So now, as a solid, it's moving. It's fluid. Then on top of that, because of the great pressure, at the very point where the water, the ice, touches the ground, the pressure of that, there's this exchange of heat. I didn't understand it when I read it. I just know it happens. And a thin, thin, thin layer of water liquefies, and the whole glacier slowly slides on it. If it was off even the tiniest of amount in its viscosity, it would not do that, and we would not have dirt. There's a miracle of surface tension as well. We think of surface tension when we watch those little bugs run across the water. This helps water break rock down, though. Because of its ability to stick together, it breaks down rock and creates the necessary minerals and nutrients for life. But then, in the same dirt that it just made, water, because of its surface tension, stays in the soil. So it breaks the rock down to turn it into soil, and then once it turns it into soil, it stays in the soil so that plants can live. Without that surface tension, it would not be there, and the plants could not live. Not only that, but that surface tension is why the tallest of the trees can have water to the very tips of their branches at the highest part, all because of the nature of capillary action and the way that surface tension works. It literally goes against gravity, and through no mechanism, that's the most fascinating thing, there's not a single piece of machinery involved in pushing water from the depths of the roots to the very tip of a branch hundreds of feet in the air. It's all just because of viscosity and surface tension. This water, in turn, is a driving force of the plates of the earth, so that through their interaction and movement of all the minerals and such, they are all pulled back into the magma of the earth and then pushed back up through the volcanic action to be turned back into soil by the water. What did I just say? I said this. We have a mountain that got made by a volcano or the pushing up of the tectonics. The water comes, knocks it down, turns it into dirt. The dirt goes into the ocean. It goes to the floor of the ocean. Oh, well, we've lost it forever. No, we haven't, because the two plates are moving together. And as they do, the one on the top scrapes over the bottom of the, or scrapes over the other side, and all of that sediment and soil is sucked back down into the mantle that turns into volcanic stuff, magma, gets spewed back up and new mountains are started, which then starts a whole process over again. All of that is happening. The whole reason the plates are able to move is because of water. Here's another thing. Water freezes, and because it freezes, it retains heat. I'm like, no. Yes. So, if it doesn't give off its heat to the atmosphere. it gives it off beneath itself. So let me back up. Water is also the only element other than something called gallium. No idea what it is. You can look it up. It's the only element in all of creation as a liquid that when it freezes, it's lighter. Why is that important? Because all other liquids freeze from the bottom up. It freezes from the top down. And because of that, life exists in the oceans and the lakes. But check this out. This is really cool. Because of that, and it is an excellent heat retainer, as it freezes, it gives off heat. But not in the atmosphere, as I said, but below it. So guess what it's doing? As it's freezing over the lake, it's sending the heat that it's giving off into the water below it so that right below that ice is a thin layer of warmer water, which is slow to freeze. And as that slowly does freeze, there comes a point of a few yards thick, and that's as thick as ice can be on water. It literally cannot get any thicker than that. And as a result of that, it keeps the water, where the fish are happy, and we get to fish the next year. If you want to know more about that, you can read the same evolutionist who wrote the book, The Wonder of Water. I bored Matt on the flight home from Ethiopia as I was reading one of these. I kept on nudging him, and he kept on looking at me and dutifully taking off his noise-canceling headphones that were not helping him at all. And I'm like, let me read you this one. It was fascinating. Get the book. All of that comes from a divine command. All of it is just the things that God has made done as the creator. And it's done in order. God has the water, then he makes the ground, then he makes the plants, then he makes the animals, and then he makes man. On the fourth day, the creation of the universe. So that's where now the planets and the sun and the moon, everything comes in. First, he gets all of this around the earth. Then he puts around all of that everything else that we can look at. These are all just creations of God. We don't have to worship them. We don't have to believe that our lives are controlled by the stars or anything else. They simply exist as created parts of his purpose. But they exist in verse 14 as a way to help us notice the passage of time and make for celebrations. That's how we know when Easter is and when Christmas is and when winter is and this and that. On day 5 and 6, we have the creation of the creatures of the water and the air and also the land creatures. And I will just deal with another question. Which came first, the chicken or the egg? The chicken. Notice he just made on day 5, everything that flies. They don't fly if they're an egg. They fly if they fly. So he just makes an adult, fully functioning animals and fish. That's my only point in that. I always have at the end of a sermon like this, did Adam have a belly button? And I just want to slap the person, so don't come up and ask me. Really, it's like, after all of this, you want to know that. Don't worry about those things. Just understand, he made a tree, not a sapling, not a seed in the ground. He made a tree. When he made rock, he made rock. Notice he doesn't say how many animals were made, what they all look like, but he does make it very clear that they're all going to propagate after their own kind. Whatever kind they are, whatever is meant by that, they're limited within that. And evolution has shown that that's true, even though it keeps insisting that it's not true over and over again. So we have all kinds of creatures, even the ones that we no longer see, but we have the fossils to know for. The woolly mammoth, the saber-toothed tiger, or the dinosaur. And according to the last part of chapter 1, all of them ate plants, and you should remember that. Because it's not natural for a lion to kill a zebra. It is the result of sin that a lion kills a zebra. And again, God expresses his approval over this handiwork, but now comes the highest one, and we'll reserve this for my next sermon. It's the creation of man. I just want you to notice in verses 26 to 31 that the creation of Adam and Eve is something that is unique, distinct. Humans were uniquely created by God with unique qualities and with a unique position. We are not an animal, and you should take offense every time somebody tries to make you an animal. In evolution, the frustrating aspect is that we are an animal, and we're the highest level of evolution, and we're also the problem for everything else. But if we are the highest point of evolution, either if we really are the problem to all of the universe, then that's the way evolution wants it, and we have no say in it. And if we're not, then let's just stop trying to make ourselves the problem, or we understand it from a biblical perspective. In the Bible, all creation is created for humanity. In the Bible, humans were not only uniquely created, but we are the bearers of God's image. And it was only after the creation of Adam and Eve that God now declares that everything that exists is now not just good, but it is very good. And from there, we see the rest of God in chapter 2. It's not a cessation of activity, because God is continuously active in his creation. It is a cessation of this creative work. That would be our Saturday, the seventh day, a holy day used to remind Israel that their God is the creator God and that he rested, and so they shall rest. But it also speaks in Hebrews 4 of a greater rest that is coming, a rest that will come in the new heavens and earth for all who are Christians, all who have believed and loved and followed their creator God and have trusted in Jesus Christ for his salvation. They will find an eternal rest where sin and death, Satan, all of our enemies are cast away and done away, where all things become new and we enter into a rest that is beyond our comprehension. We also see in this that God is a God of order. I thought of this regarding us spiritually, that there were a day when every one of you who is a Christian, especially those who became a Christian later in life, where you once walked in darkness and then all of a sudden something turned on, right? Something clicked and you just saw. And you're like, how did I not see this before? But it's how God works. And it's a reality that the humanity walks in the darkness of sin. There's no real form in our life. We're just making it through life and then we die. And at the end of it, so often people say, that's it. That's all there was. But in Christ, God enters our darkness, and out of that formlessness and purposelessness, he gives form and purpose. He begins to bring order. In fact, that's what you and I would call the act of sanctifying us, that he has taken you from your broken state and he's conforming you into the image of his son. He's just doing it on an individual basis, what he did with all of creation. It's because God decreed it to be. It's also the fact that because of God being the God of order, that things are not changing into new species. They just continue to function in the vastness of the DNA that God has given them within their own kind. And then finally, it shows us God caring and providing for his creation. And we'll see this next time I preach, that this shows us how that God shows us what it looks like to care for the world we live in. Because he's given us the task to rule and to care for his creation. Beloved, when you look at the Bible and you read the stories where Jesus is on the earth and he's walking and he comes to water and he walks on the water, it's not a miracle. Matt did say it was a miracle, and I'm not debating what he is saying. It's not a miracle in any real sense, though, because all it really is the creator God telling water to obey. That's all. It's a miracle to you and I, but it's nothing to Jesus. It's not like, whoa, it worked. He's the one that made it. And so when the water is ready to destroy the fishermen in the boat, the disciples, and they wake him up and say, don't you care? He looks at me and says, have you no faith? And he looks at the water and he speaks as the creator God and he says, be still. And it doesn't argue, it just becomes still. And when he holds the bread in his hand, and he looks at the thousands of hungry people and he starts to break it and feed it. It's not something freaky. It's just the creator God doing what creator God does. He just makes bread, a whole bunch of bread. When there's wine that needs to be made, he makes wine. When there's a blind man that needs to be healed, he makes his eyes see. When the lame man needs to walk, he says, walk, and he walks. And praise God, when the dead man is dead, he can say, come out. And the man comes out. And beloved, when he looks at you dead in your sins and he says, live, you live. This is not an exercise of science. This is a statement of the fact that God is sovereign in all things and that we are his creatures and we are to function in light of that.